Okay, so this is the brief outline that I have here, which is to, I should say I'm a particle theorist, unlike Ayana, our last speaker. So I want to rephrase a few things that she told you about the LHC and the physics it can address, in particular these issues of the machine, the physics of electroweak unification, and one of the grand puzzles that we are trying to confront, both experimentally and theoretically. I want to describe one scenario that answers this. There's a real plot to the story, and I hope to get that across. And that involves the exciting physics of extra dimensions. But partly, it's a good thing in a less specialized context to discuss particle physics, because a lot of it can be put in pictorial terms. So I hope to take a cartoon approach to the subject. And then I want to put these two things together and say why, if this plot is fulfilled, there's a good chance of seeing extra dimensions at the LHC. And of course, I need to say what it means to see. Okay. So there are these special moments in the history of science where two disparate phenomena are seen to have a common explanation, a common understanding, and a common source. And so we know, for example, electromagnetism itself is the merging of two words, electricity and magnetism. We know that these look rather different when you first confront them in everyday life, but we know deeply since the 19th century that they belong within the same understanding known as electromagnetism. And in fact, light itself is a symptom of this merger. They are electromagnetic waves. Well, we are similarly at the, you know, at a point in history where we're going to see the merging of two forces of nature that look very different: radioactivity, electromagnetism, within a new understanding, a new theory, the electroweak unified theory. And this is not something that we have directly seen the central part of the plot. We've seen so much circumstantial evidence that we know this is going to happen on our watch. But the central part of it is, why do these two forces look different in the first place if they're all part of this unified mother force, the electroweak theory? And the answer is the Higgs mechanism, which Ayana told you a little bit about, and I'll rephrase it for my own purposes. There are many aspects to this story, very beautiful aspects. I will focus for us on something very tangible. The masses of all the known elementary particles have to come about due to the bifurcation of this unified theory into these two separate forces by virtue of the Higgs mechanism. And what's so special about the LHC is that it is poised and designed to explore this, you know, as I say, revolution. It doesn't happen all that often in physics that two forces of nature unify on your watch, okay? And there's a mystery associated with that, which I'd like to talk about. So there's something very special about mass in the theory of special relativity. All massless particles have to travel at the speed of light. So even particles of light, photons, of course, are massless, and they travel at the speed of light. And all massive particles have to travel below the speed of light. Okay, so it's a simple rule. If you pump in enough energy, you can make a massive particle travel any fraction of the speed of light except one. Okay, so it can be 0.99 the speed of light, as will be the case of the LHC. But the standard model of particle physics has emerged from a kind of a paradox, which is the structure of the interactions that you're being forced to tell you that all of the elementary particles we've seen should actually be massless. They should actually be traveling at the speed of light all the time. Whereas we know from experiment that particles like the electron actually have mass, and they travel slower than the speed of light. And so this paradox has a resolution, a trick, if you like. And it takes the loophole here, is that what we call the vacuum, empty space, in quantum and relativistic physics does not have to be empty. It just has to appear to be empty. Okay? It can actually be a rich bath that contains particles in a very clever disguise, one of which is that it can be a bath or condensate of what are called Higgs bosons, a special type of particle that was alluded to in the last talk. So the purpose of these two purposes of the Higgs boson, okay? I mean, one is it should hide. It should actually fake. It's all over the place, but this bath of Higgs particles should be undetectable. It should evade all those tests for an ether that were performed 100 years ago, really faking being invisible, not just like glass, which is invisible, but invisible to the most devious experiments that we can put forward, okay, at least up till now. And its central purpose is to slow down most of the massive elementary particles in some way so they don't travel at the speed of light, okay? How does it do it? Well, here's roughly the cartoon, and it's not a bad cartoon in being faithful to the math. So some particles, like the top quark, so here is my bath of Higgs particles, Higgs bosons. I've drawn them in like this. There's some chaotic dance they're doing. Of course, it's all quite invisible, so this is the vacuum here. And here's a top quark trying to make its way through. It's traveling literally at the speed of light. On the other hand, it's bumping around so that on average, its progress is slower than the speed of light. For a fixed amount of energy that we push in to trying to make the particle make its way through from left to right, an electron bounces along far less and therefore makes its way on average much faster for a given amount of energy than the top quark. So the electron is lighter than the top quark. And here's a photon. It doesn't interact with the Higgs bosons at all and travels literally at the speed of light. Okay. So the LHC is designed, one of its grand purposes, is to bring the Higgs boson out of hiding. And we can think of it this way. Here is the vacuum full of these Higgs particles. And the protons we're going to smash together are going to explode one of these Higgs particles every now and then out of hiding. It moves along. It's not in this invisibility dance with its brothers here, and then crashes back into the condensate, releasing some ultraviolet light, which these grand detectors, these eyes that we have, see, and then hopefully we can sift it out from the other large background, and we can actually identify that we have seen one of these Higgs bosons. The critical amount of energy, why do you need so much energy? Because the energy cost of doing this is E, where M is the mass of the Higgs boson. Okay, so that's the plan, but there's a puzzle, okay? So what's the mystery here? There is a kind of whodunit that has to be resolved, and that is called a hierarchy problem, which is a question, for my purpose, it can be phrased, it has many ways of phrasing it. For my purpose, it's a question of why is gravity so weak? And when you say that to the ordinary person, they say, it doesn't seem that weak to me. For example, it's strong enough that I am not able to do this trick, okay? So this is somebody else. But the real thing is this trick can be done. Many, many people, maybe some in the audience, can do it. And really, the viewpoint, this is the wrong viewpoint to say, oh, I'm struggling to do this. The real thing is if you can do it at all, you should look at it this way, okay? Which is, you know, by action and reaction, you should say, look, I'm holding up the whole Earth this way. And if gravity was much stronger, in a sense, you would be splattered by the Earth. This is not the detector, it's, of course, the Titan. So really, the question should be asked not by looking at Earth and human, we should look at it on a per particle basis. And here are two elementary particles, and I've chosen the two particles that we know of that would have the strongest gravitational attraction, because they are the heaviest particles that we know of, which are elementary particles. They're top quarks. And so in these little black arrows, I've drawn their usual Newtonian attraction. And here is their electrostatic repulsion in the blue lines, okay, although not drawn to scale. In fact, the ratio of these two forces acting on the top quark is this enormous or tiny number, okay? And so one question is, why is it so? Why is this fundamental ratio of forces given by this? That could just be an input parameter to a theory, except that theoretically, when we study this in relativistic and quantum physics, we find that this number has to emerge as the result of cancellation among a number of contributions, all of which are order one, okay? So a number of order one contributions, you have to somehow believe magically cancels to this degree. Either that's the picture in the standard model, or something else is going on, okay? So one gamble is something else is going on. This is implausibly the result of a number of cancellations to that degree. And extra dimensions of space-time are one possible answer to that conundrum, okay, or puzzle. I should say that the one talks about even this direction, There are a number of earlier precedents than the story I'm going to tell you. Perhaps the best known, in some sense, and in many people's view, the best bet, is supersymmetry itself, which sometimes is called fermionic extra dimensions in a sense that I won't explain, at least not during the talk, but you can ask me afterwards. And then there are other scenarios that are known as brain world scenarios. Again, I won't discuss these in any great detail. I instead will talk about something that emerged from this scenario, which I'll call warp compactifications with bulk standard model. Okay, so it's not got a catchy title yet. Warp compactifications for short. And I want to say, why is this giving a sort of pleasing picture of particle physics, in particular the hierarchy problem? But I first have to say, how do we even think about extra dimensions? Okay. So the first thing to understand, rather than imagine a dimension that you've never seen before, is to imagine how you could have lost a dimension that you are perfectly familiar with. Okay, how do you lose a dimension? And so imagine going into some, you know, booth at the state fair where they advertise that they will lose you a dimension. And so you walk in here, and they put you between two mirrors. Okay, and as you walk in there, the mirrors are getting closer and closer, and then they turn on the machine, and it squashes you as flat as a pancake, but somehow doesn't kill you. So there you are, stuck between these two mirrors, flat as a pancake. You spend enough time there, you even begin to wonder if there is a third dimension. And so there's the third dimension. As far as you're concerned, you are only able to move in this little sandwich. You are constrained to move in two dimensions. The third dimension is so tiny that maybe it's only a few molecules thick that you can hardly see it. Your eyes are totally directed in the direction parallel to the mirrors, and you can only move in the direction parallel to the mirrors. You have effectively become a flat two-dimensional creature with a flat two-dimensional life. Okay. I won't make any jokes about that. You spend enough time in the halls of theoretical physics, this is what happens. I want to just take one topic. I said you lost your peripheral vision, your sight is purely two-dimensional. How exactly did you lose your sight, peripheral sight? Even if you're that thin, maybe you could squeeze a look to the side and see the third dimension. Do you really lose it? Well, let's just take that one topic and see how you lost your sight in the third dimension. So here is the story of peripheral vision. Of course, your vision is made by seeing electromagnetic fields, waves of light. And so here's the usual cartoon of that. I'm going to simplify these complicated pictures of electromagnetic waves to just talking about, say, the magnetic field component of an electromagnetic wave. Of course, we know that the wavelength of light is correlated with the color that we experience. And normally, this is a continuous phenomenon. You can get any color you want in that visual range. But I want to consider what happens. Why did I say that you were squashed by mirrors, just to make my life easy? And that's because I want to consider how the light, imagine light going peripherally, that is going directed into a mirror on the side. That light goes along and then it gets reflected, and there's some condition or boundary condition here. Roughly speaking, the condition for this magnetic component is that the mirror image is smoothly connected in this way. It looks like a continuation of the wave. Okay. Now, that doesn't seem like it has much impact. Of course, you can't have this kinky thing. That's what I'm trying to say. You have a smooth continuation. And that gets its teeth when you consider that there are two mirrors, one on each side. And so light traveling in the sideways direction is forced to go, it meets its mirror image either at a peak or a trough, so that it does it smoothly, and similarly on the other side, so that there are these four options, peak, peak, trough, trough, peak, trough, trough, peak, and you can easily figure out that this manages to discretize the possible wavelengths of light, or the possible colors that you can see in your peripheral vision. Here's the formula that captures these pictures, that the number of wiggles between the two mirrors is a whole number, where a wiggle is a half wavelength. Okay, so that's the rule. And when you do that, let's just do an example where 2 microns is the separation between the two mirrors. Okay, just one example. In that case, these colors that I've drawn in here are the only visual, I mean, the only wavelengths that are allowed that are in the visual range. Further up, allowed waves are in the infrared, and further down, they're in the ultraviolet. So while normally you see in the full range of colors, your peripheral vision now is contained in just these four discrete colors. You can plot that as a function of wavelength or color, and you can say, what are all the allowed colors by this discretization between the mirrors? Here's the visual ones, the ones in the visual range. And such a spectrum, when you have a finite size sideways direction, is called a Kaluza-Klein spectrum. I'll explain where the words Kaluza-Klein came from later. But this is an example where you're restricted to these colors. Well, at least a discrete set of colors is better than no vision in the sideways direction at all. And in fact, when you go to, I think, 100 nanometers, say, as an example two, an even smaller separation between the two mirrors, in fact, all of the colors are in the far ultraviolet. You can't see anything sideways which is not in the far ultraviolet, and so you have lost your peripheral vision if you're confining it to the visible range. Okay? So the lights are out at some definite separation. Lights are out, at least in your peripheral vision, at some definite separation between these two mirrors. But you can still see. It's just that you can only see in waves that are propagating parallel to the mirror. So there is this case where the number of wiggles in the sideways direction is zero. There are no wiggles. So that whole number I talked about is called zero, and we call these zero modes. But you can still have the wave wiggling along the mirror. And so you can still have and that there's absolutely no discretization of wavelength there. So you can see the usual set of colors and images, but only in the two-dimensional sense. Okay, so we've gone through the anatomy of how you've lost the sensation of the third dimension. And so we can just repeat the question. Once you see how you could have lost the third dimension, you can ask, well, I haven't lost the third dimension. We're all here. But have I lost some other dimension from birth so that I've never experienced this dimension? And you might say, well, that must be the fourth dimension. Of course, we know in relativity, for other reasons, time is referred to as the fourth dimension. So we have to call this extra dimension of space the fifth dimension. Okay, so that's the notation I'll use. And we have to ask, well, I don't have enough dimensions to draw this realistically, but this picture from before is going to be our metaphor for what might be happening. There's a fifth dimension here. There are three dimensions which are totally unconstrained, but the fifth dimension is somehow sandwiched between two hypermirrors, because each mirror is actually a three-dimensional boundary of space. Okay, and somehow these mirrors keep going, so they're truly cosmic. And what we see is mostly is just the zero-mode light, the light that travels along the mirrors. Okay. So quantum mechanics intrudes in this story, and it says that there's a cost, and it literally translates into dollars in the end. It's an energy cost for each particle of light that is in the transverse direction. You say, why is it so hard to look in the transverse direction? Okay, a human can't see in the peripheral side because they have an optical range, but what about, you know, some clever machine? Well, there's an energy per photon that you have to pay, which is given by this famous formula, Planck's constant times frequency, or if you want, Planck's constant times speed of light over the wavelength. And if you translate that discrete spectrum, Kaluza-Klein spectrum, to the energy per photon traveling in the sideways direction, you get this kind of a tower, these are called the Kaluza-Klein excitations of the photon. The smaller the size of the fifth dimension, the bigger is the energy cost to produce even the first Kaluza-Klein excitation. And that's why it's hard to do. This is true for actually all the other particles. Photons are easy because you know that light is made of waves, but in fact, even electrons in quantum mechanics have wave functions. And so everything I said about photons is true for electrons, quarks, you name it. They also have a Kaluza-Klein excitation, set of excitations in the fifth dimension. If the fifth dimension exists, then there should be some sort of a spectrum like this. Well, colliders are a great way of producing, of paying this energy cost. That if we can get quarks and antiquarks from protons to annihilate in front of us, then they can annihilate into ultraviolet photons, for example. And most of these ultraviolet photons might go off in the directions in the usual three dimensions, but it's possible that they might just go off in the fifth dimension. And here's a picture of what that would look like in a collider experiment. So here are these zero modes, the usual stuff that we're all made out of, just like photons have zero modes, quarks have zero modes. And here's the quark wave function representing two beams of quark and antiquark, or parts of protons, colliding. So they're propagating in three dimensions and colliding. And then the energy of that collision is going into exciting these Kaluza-Klein excitations, wiggles in the fifth dimension. And then this goes along for a while, and that energy has some amplitude, probability, of going back to wiggles in three dimensions. So the wiggles from three dimensions can be transferred to wiggles in the fifth dimension, but then they go back to doing their old thing. And we can try and look for this behavior by looking at the decay product. So this photon, this excitation of the photon, is short-lived, but the energy should agree with the energy of the decay products, and we can study the energy of the decay products and look for some sort of discrete set of excitation energies. So that is the schematic search for extra dimensions in a particle collider. But guess what? We've been doing particle collider physics for some decades, and no Kaluza-Klein excitations have been found. And so you can put a bound, since the excitation energy is inversely proportional to the size of the fifth dimension, you can put a bound on just what that size could be. And in the scenario I'm talking about, that would put it at this incredibly tiny length scale. Now, the LHC, compared to its predecessor colliders, will zoom in. Okay, so there's actually an interesting and general point in particle physics. Let me say that here, which is we often say that particle colliders, these vast machines, are a kind of, they're particle accelerators, then particle smashers, atom smashers. But they're also a big magnifying glass. And sometimes that may not be apparent. What's this big infusion of energy into a small region got to do with being a big magnifying glass? And I hope that's clear from this picture. This is illustrative of a much more general principle. We've studied why, in order to see the size, a small size of a fifth dimension, you pay an energy cost to do it. Okay, that's what I've just reviewed. And so high energy, if we have access to high energy, which we put into a new elementary particle that goes sideways in the fifth dimension, we are able to resolve the fifth dimension to the extent a very small fifth dimension requires a high energy to even produce the first wiggle in an extra dimension. Okay? We need to wiggle in an extra dimension to know it's there. In that sense, the high energy buys us a magnifying glass. Okay, so the LHC is going to zoom in that sense, as a magnifying glass. It's zooming in another order of magnitude, very roughly speaking, over its predecessors. But we haven't seen anything yet. And why would you even imagine that you're going to see anything by just going up one more factor of 10 in magnification? Okay. After all, there is this inconvenient principle of science called Occam's razor. And so we've got plenty of space right now, and who needs the extra? Okay. So I just quickly go through a little bit of the history, a lightning review of some of the history and motivations of extra dimensions. They entered modern physics, I think, soon after the emergence of general relativity as a curved space-time theory of gravity. And one of the observations made by Kaluza and Klein, whose names resonate through the subject, is that if you study the theory of gravity, general relativity, on an extra-dimensional space which is not an interval sandwiched between two mirrors, but actually a circle. So it's a small-sized circle, and here are the usual three dimensions going. I've only got one dimension to draw them in. So this is a kind of hypercylinder. Then they found the most remarkable thing. They said, I'm only going to study general relativity. I'm only putting gravity on this five-dimensional space-time. But if I look at particles that go clockwise around the extra dimensions and particles that go anti-clockwise around the extra dimensions, those particles not only have a gravitational force, they seem to have an electromagnetic force as well, where clockwise is positive electric charge and anti-clockwise is negative electric charge. And so if, even if you can't see the extra dimension, it's too small to see, you would see two forces for the price of one. Okay, we all understand a bargain when we see it. Two forces for the price of one. You put in gravity in five dimensions and you get electromagnetism and gravity in four dimensions. Now that is a, that satisfies Occam's razor, okay? The tragedy of it was that it was stunningly beautiful. It still is a stunningly beautiful exercise in theoretical physics, but some crucial features of nature, which I don't want to go into, do not emerge in a kind of way. Decade after decade you study it and they don't seem to emerge. But the natural inheritor of these ideas, I think, in the modern age belongs to string theory. And I just want to say what properties of string theory I'm going to carry forward in this talk, okay? First, it is motivated because it's the best developed approach to unifying or understanding the coexistence of two things that we plainly see in experiments, gravity and quantum mechanics, okay? So there has to be some theory behind it, and this is the best developed such approach. Incidentally, from the point of view of this talk, but crucially for the success of that theory, it replaces the idea of point particles. You go with a big magnifying glass and you see the point particle is actually a loop of string. Okay, so the fundamental object is not point-like, but one-dimensional. That's incidental to the rest of my talk, as I say. The main thing for the rest of my talk is they automatically contain extra dimensions of space-time. The simplest constructions have it as a necessary feature of this merger. Okay. Two, they contain objects similar to my cosmic mirrors. You might say, gee, that's a crazy thing to put into a theory. But they have objects like that in them. Okay. So it contains many of the ingredients I'm talking about. And not only that, there are versions of string theory which even generalize the sort of beautiful math of Kaluza and Klein's calculations. Okay. So, in that sense, it's the inheritor of the Kaluza-Klein ideas. So this is the broad framework that informs our ideas of what to try to solve, you know, interesting problems in physics. Here's, for the plot of my story, here is one of the main picture, okay? Which is, what can you hide in an extra dimension? It's a good hiding place. And one of the things you can hide is gravity pulling in the extra-dimensional direction. Okay, so to distinguish that from what you're used to, here is a picture of the Earth's surface curving in three dimensions, and here is a tree, and here is Newton's apple, and it's being pulled towards the center of the Earth, and this is the usual gravitational field that you're used to pulling in the usual three dimensions, which is why we actually observe its effects. But if these mirrors are not absolutely symmetric in every regard, and generically they're not, then there can well be a gravitational field pulling in the extra dimension, okay? Pulling in the sideways direction, this new sideways that I've introduced here. And this is quite generic. And you might say, why is it pulling this way and not this way? There can easily be an asymmetry in the mass density of mirror one relative to the mass density of mirror two. And then this is quite a generic possibility. It has a name, this kind of feature. And it comes from the fact that, of course, gravitational fields, since Einstein, we understand them as really curved space-time. And so when I say there's a strong gravitational field pulling in the sideways direction, what I really mean is the space-time between these two mirrors is highly curved. I don't want to go into the highly curved part during my talk. I'm just going to draw it as pullers in the sideways direction, just like pullers in the apple downwards. But the word for this kind of hidden curvature is called warping. And so these kind of setups are called warped compactifications. Compact referring to the compact size of the extra dimension, and warped referring to the sideways gravity, which in the mathematical description is given by curved space-time. So what? Who cares? There's a hidden gravitational field. Well, if we turn this picture on its side so that we think of this as the roof this is the ceiling and this as the floor, okay? We can ask, what difference does gravity make anyway? And here's the trick. The trick is that when you have a gravitational field, things tend to localize in different ways in reaction to it. So they can depend on, of course, there may be some other forces in play. There may be, here's a chandelier with some force that's holding it to the ceiling, hopefully. That's part of how it tends to end up where it is. Here's a gas-filled balloon. Here's a gas-filled balloon, but it's tied to a chair. The chair is on the ground, and so on. So things tend to localize differently when you have a gravitational field, and that's still true of sideways gravitational fields. In particular, the zero modes. Okay, I talked about zero modes of the photon is something which is the no wiggle version of what a wave of light can do between the two mirrors. Here it is. And all the other particles that we can talk about, like gravitons, which are to gravity, what photons are to light. Here's a graviton zero mode, here's an electron zero mode, here's a top quark zero mode. And if there were no five-dimensional gravity, if I just shut it off in my mind's eye, then they would all do what I just taught you, which is they just have no wiggles, no nothing, no features. And these are all the particles that have no cost, no energy cost in the extra dimension, no Kaluza-Klein excitation cost. These modes cost nothing, and that's what the stuff we're all made of, the sort of the most relaxed stuff you can find in nature. Okay. So this is the boring picture, but when you turn on the fifth dimensional gravity, warping, they tend to do different things. Okay? So when you go away and you study Einstein's equations coupled to Maxwell's equations, coupled to the Dirac equation in higher dimensional space-time, you end up with this type of reaction of the zero modes, all the stuff we're made of. And things localize in different ways. And so that at least looks interesting. It looks like some interesting structure emerges automatically for free. And we can ask, what can you do with it? Well, even the sort of sinusoidal Kaluza-Klein excitation also do interesting things. They get warped in some way by the gravitational pull. But why is this so interesting? What's so interesting about having an extra dimension? Well, the secret, just like any other piece of real estate, is given by the usual slogan, okay? You see, like in real estate, particles tend to interact mostly with the particles they find closest to them, okay? Just like people. And this tendency to have an interesting and structured set of wave functions or profiles in the extra dimensions says that, for example, a top quark tends to be in a different place in the extra dimension typically than an electron. An electron tends to be in a similar place to a graviton, and so on. Okay, so there's some set of tendencies that are there, and I want to focus on just one of them, which is all I have time for, but I'll just give the general interesting, beautiful point, which is that these localizing tendencies for different species in different places in the extra dimension helps to explain, I think, one of the questions that was asked here, which is, why do we get different interaction strengths between different species of particles? We see a very interesting pattern of them in nature. And part of the puzzle of particle physics is, why is that the case? This pattern I'm showing you tends to give a rather good explanation, not to several decimal places, but at least a kind of qualitative explanation of the tendencies we see in the data. And that's why it's being taken very seriously. I want to focus on just one of those tendencies of interaction strengths, which is the hierarchy problem, the strength of gravity relative to other forces. So if you look here, you see that rather automatically, the graviton zero mode, that's the graviton which makes up the gravitational field that's pulling me right now down to the Earth, that graviton tends to localize, tend to lean to a different side from where the Higgs condensate, the collection of Higgs bosons, tends to lean to the opposite side. And here, the graviton is the stuff that pulls on mass. We all know that. And as I've told you today, the Higgs boson is the thing that creates the illusion, if you like, of mass. It takes all those massless particles racing around at the speed of light in the standard model of particle physics, and it gives them mass, okay, by their interactions with the Higgs condensate. So this is a rather efficient way of explaining why gravity is so weak, because the thing pulling is in a different place from the thing that's giving the mass. It's like if I'm here and you're trying to pull me by pulling on my hair, you don't do a very good job of it, okay? So this is part of the grand explanation of this mystery of the hierarchy problem. There are a number of other such explanations of interaction strengths that are hidden in this kind of picture. For example, the top quark is heavy because it is more aligned with the Higgs condensate, which tends to slow it down, and in relativity, that means give it mass. The electron is light, that's this yellow invisible line, because it is not aligned with the Higgs condensate. It tends to be in a different place. It interacts less with the Higgs condensate, slows down less, and tends to be light. So that's the plot, and I hope you get a sense that it's a grand plot, one of only a few such grand plots. That is, there are very few known mechanisms. If there were 100, then maybe we would take each one less seriously. But there are very few. There's order a handful of known mechanisms to the hierarchy problem that give a certain level of intellectual satisfaction to the physicists. And this is one of them. So we're talking about it, and it's quite visualizable, which is probably why I'm here. So the prediction is, if this is the mechanism that's solving the hierarchy problem, there's a rough prediction, which is that the energy cost of these Kaluza-Klein excitations of the photon or of the electron, that it is roughly of the ballpark of mc squared, the same formula we keep coming across in the subject, where the m is roughly speaking the mass, the biggest mass that the Higgs condensate can. The biggest mass that the Higgs condensate can ever give a particle. And we know we're not too far from that, because the top quark is so massive that it's pretty much exploiting the Higgs mechanism to give it mass to the hilt. And so it's great news. We should have Kaluza-Klein excitations at the LHC, because we are certainly, the LHC is a top factory. It's going to produce a gazillion tops. Somebody here could probably tell me exactly how many. But it's going to produce tons of tops, so it should produce tons of Kaluza-Klein excitations. However, caution, this prediction, this link, if you solve the hierarchy problem, solving it is a kind of a soft qualitative term, and this prediction is therefore only an order of magnitude estimate in an experimental game where details actually make a difference. So you have to be cautious about that. And there's good reason to be cautious. I don't want to oversell anything. And so I want to, in this slide, talk about a different direction of particle physics research, which is not just measuring to the highest possible energies, but measuring with great precision, which is the kind of physics that we've been doing for quite some time now in particle physics, in a whole array of particle physics experiments. You see, there is this little matter of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The very word energy cost suggests that if you want something to happen, you have to pay the energy cost, and if you don't have that, you have only one dime less, you can't have it. You can't produce the Kaluza-Klein photon and see it. And in a certain sense, that's true. There's this discrete energy cost to producing a Kaluza-Klein photon and saying we've entered the fifth dimension. But the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that energy conservation itself can be violated for a short period of time, the product given by Planck's famous constant. That means that for a brief period of time, you can violate energy conservation at a lower energy particle collider, like the ones that have been running all this time with great precision. And for a short period of time, even if your energy is less than the energy cost of a Kaluza-Klein excitation, you can briefly, if you like, get a quick fleeting glance at the new physics that's around the corner. And the only thing is, like any fleeting glance, you only get a kind of shade of what you're looking for. Okay, you get some quick sneak peek, and it's not easy to discern what you're seeing. But still, if you have great precision in your sight, then maybe you should have already seen the physics of extra dimensions at past particle colliders, which have been executed with great precision, with great understanding of the speed and the physics involved. And guess what? We haven't seen it, okay? So these so-called virtual Kaluza-Klein effects of extra dimensions, the fact that we haven't seen those puts some rather strong bounds on the statement that we're going to see them tomorrow at the LHC. In fact, the bounds would be roughly like this, okay? That the energy of the Kaluza-Klein, the first Kaluza-Klein excitation, would be a few TeV. That happens, as I say, details matter. And that's right at the limits of what the LHC is capable of producing in this 14 TeV machine when you take all the efficiencies and inefficiencies into account. So one thing we know, compared to supersymmetry, which was discussed by Ayana in the last lecture, is that hunting for Kaluza-Klein excitations at the LHC is going to be, in this scenario, which is, I think, one of the favorite scenarios for extra dimensions, is going to be very, very challenging. I'd like to say just a quick word. This story of how warp compactifications address the hierarchy problem is the work of many hands. That's a good thing, because humans being what they are, there's a lot of adversarial, you know, discussions and checks and cross-checks and so on. So a lot of the ideas come hand in hand. You know, every other paper in this list is practically somebody saying, hey, wait, not so fast. If your clever idea was right, we should have seen this in this other experiment in some virtual test looking using Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And in some sense, you know, everybody proposing is like a used car salesman trying to hide all the deficits of their car while selling all its merits. But the good thing is, the other used car salesmen are the consumers, and so they know all the dirty tricks. So I just want to say that the psychology of the field is as interesting as the subject itself. And certainly, this tale I'm telling you was no exception. A lot of, back and forth in this, and it's still going on. That's why the ellipsis is there. So what will this look like at the LHC? Well, it'll look very much like the schematic discussion I gave before, except if you look at all these zero-mode profiles, they're all a little distorted, like I had a shaky hand on the airplane. That's actually just the effect of warping. Okay, that's a detail to you. Mainly, wiggles in three dimensions, the wave functions of colliding protons, is translated into wiggles in the fifth dimension, which then de-excites by more wiggles in the usual three dimensions. And one of the favored decay modes of not a KK photon, turns out that's, for detailed reasons, a little harder to see. Here's the KK gluon, the Kaluza-Klein gluon excitation, which gluons are to the strong nuclear force what photons are to the electromagnetic force. And so wiggles of the KK gluon de-excite through producing anti-top quarks and top quarks. And here are their wave functions wiggling in three dimensions. And so the job of finding this KK, I should have said KK gluon, not photon, the energy of the KK gluon translates into the energy of the top quark and energy of the anti-top quark. So looking for this discrete spectrum, if you like, is looking in the decay products and trying to see this resonance or bump when you hit the energy needed, the energy cost of a KK gluon. Of course, as I said, the LHC is a top factory, and so top quarks are flying all around the place, and you have to, again, pick this out of the background. That's very challenging. There are some studies that have been done, but this is the challenge and the motivation for extra dimensions at the LHC. And this is, again, just a sliver of the literature, if you like, and the excitement of extra dimensions, which goes in many different directions. James Wells, maybe the next speaker, will be talking about quite a different motivation for, at least one of the things he'll talk about is quite different. There are these other scenarios that address the hierarchy problem that I haven't talked about. But it connects to a number of very interesting topics, and so this research into extra dimensions has been, you know, going strong for some number of decades, and the last decade more than ever, in a number of interesting directions. Thank you.
enjoyed your talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like you to expound briefly, if you could. I understand that I'm being pulled into my chair 9.8 meters per second squared constantly, that I don't even think about it unless I try to jump or I take a fall. So according to your mirror example, I'm actually being pulled at a much greater acceleration into a dimension I can't conceive or perceive. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, it's, you might say, why don't I feel it? And we tend to sense everything by contrast. So my statement is, you're already feeling it. And in fact, you could ask, what would happen if I weren't feeling it? So let me go back to, say, this picture here. And Gordy's wave function is already transposed. So for example, here is an electron or a quark inside a proton in your body. It's already sort of being, in fact, it's like the gas balloon or something. It's already sort of going the opposite way to the gravitational pull. But anyway, it is reacting to it, right? And one of the things is, it's being pulled far away from the Higgs condensate, which is like the chair sinking to the floor. And if it weren't so, all those particles in your body would be slowed by moving through the Higgs condensate orders of magnitude more than they are right now. So that those particles would become very, very heavy, and you would literally splatter, you know, against the floor in the three-dimensional sense. Okay. So a number of things that you take for granted are in this gravitational field. And were it not there, you would sure notice. But because you've grown up from birth in a gravitational field that's not varying in any direction you can travel, you don't notice it. You've evolved this whole time in it. So the real trick in this game for the imagination is to understand, I can't, why don't I feel it? And you must always say, how do I feel things? How do I sense things? Always by contrast. But you can't escape this field. Okay. Wherever you move, it's there. So it's really to think in terms of contrast.
The KK gluon destruction, when it you're going to produce it and then it's going to go away, and you're going to detect the things that it turns into when it goes away. What are detection issues with that time frame? And do you have that time frame figured out? I mean, how is it going to last? You know, how long does the KK gluon last? And if it's so short that you can't detect it, that's a kind of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. So in fact, it would be very nice in particle physics, and maybe in the past to some extent it's true, with some very special particles, that they live long enough that there's, often in time, a split second, but long enough for them to travel some macroscopic distance that you can actually go and measure the distance. So the bottom quark is an example of a particle that we produce in these kind of accelerators, which actually has that kind of macroscopic decay length, as it's called. These kinds of particles are kind of 0-1 in the following sense. They either have very special reasons why they don't decay at all, okay? And James will talk about what difference that might make to us in one example. But the kind that I've been talking about here would decay so rapidly that they would hardly travel any, they would certainly not travel, they would only travel a microscopic distance before they decay. A microscopic in the sense, a fraction of the size of a proton length before they decay. So entirely the search is for the energy of the decay products. And you might say, what are you supposed to see? Okay, you see some energy of the decay products. But what you're looking for, very much like the Higgs search in this sense, is you're plotting the, let me call it energy of top plus anti-top pairs. It's really something that should be called the invariant mass, but it doesn't matter. Energy. And in this axis, I'm going to plot, this is the number of events, okay? And here I'm saying the energy of the top plus anti-top pairs. And there's some smooth, if there was no such thing as an extra dimension, there would still be lots of top anti-top pairs being produced at the LHC, and there's some smooth distribution. But because there is these special energies at which you can produce Kaluza-Klein excitations that decay into top anti-top pairs, you would look for these bumps, which correspond to the Kaluza-Klein spectrum. This is what you're looking for. Now, this is a 50-year sweep of the physics I would like to cover. This is perhaps, in the best case, the LHC reach in this scenario. There are other extra-dimensional scenarios out there. I haven't talked about them. I just wanted to do one interesting case. But even here, you would discover this as a kind of a discrete bump in what would otherwise have been a smooth background distribution. And you're looking at only the energy of the decay products, not looking at the Kaluza-Klein particle while it is alive and studying it. And a lot of particle physics is done in this mode.
In your scheme of extra dimension, the underlying theory is relativity and quantum mechanics combined.
Yes.
And what I'm wondering is, some time ago there was talk about something which moved with faster than light, tachyon. Does it? Is there anything that you can say about that?
So there is this kind of theory is very conservative, okay, in the sense that it does not have any faster than light movement. Faster than light sounds like it might just be, you know, there's a speed limit. We all like to break speed limits, and so we should and could, and nature should. But the speed limit in relativity is at least plays a sort of pivotal role, in the sense that that speed limit is the key to having what we call causality in relativity. That is, the causes precede the effects. And so these theories make sense to us, that as we understand cause preceding effect, they're built in that sort of conservative mode. Extra dimensions sound pretty radical, but they're conservative in that we at least, they make sense in the way we normally do physics. So they don't have tachyons of the type that are occasionally, you know, talked about.
Yes, I'd like to ask you, I get the feeling for, you know, the path that you're taking with the extra dimensionality. And I'm thinking, say, from a mathematician standpoint, say you had a hypercube, you know, be it four-dimensional, five-dimensional, whatever dimension you wish.
Yeah.
Is there a sort of an isomorphism between your approach and the strict mathematical, not thinking of any other particular physical reality other than orthogonal extensions? I just wondered, do they connect? And I'm just sometimes lost in the jargon of dimensionality, wondering which crosses over and which does not.
So this kind of physics very much is the same kind of extension of dimensionality that the mathematicians would be comfortable talking with. And in some sense, there's some historical convergence of these ideas if you go back far in time. So in the 19th century, people were studying curved surfaces. And then they realized the mathematics of curved surfaces. Math is like doing, you know, what you can see with your eyes of the curvature of a surface, like a sphere or a donut. You can do it mathematically blindly, as if you've never seen. Okay, so you can capture it blind. When you can understand things blindly, you can generalize very easily. And so in the 19th century, they generalized to higher dimensional surfaces. They generalized to objects which are two-dimensional surfaces, like the Klein bottle, which, however, can only be embedded in four-dimensional space, I should say. So there were a number of generalizations mathematically which naturally went to higher dimensions. When general relativity came as a real theory of curved space-time, needed to understand physical phenomena like gravity, it wasn't long after before people said, "Well, curves, space-time." It went hand in hand with extra-dimensional generalization, and not too surprisingly, very soon after general relativity, we have these generalizations to higher dimensions of space-time. So the mathematics of higher dimensions of space-time and curved space-time is very much in keeping with the kind of physics of higher dimensions and higher space-time that I'm talking about here. It's the same kind of thing.
Okay, one little quick question first. It seemed like you'd have an event if you have a KK thing. Event occurs, and then there's another event that has no precursor, just kind of pops up and you see it. In other words, it went in the other dimension, you now have the results, and some have come back into our observable three dimensions. That's how I saw the interaction. So is that now what you're looking for, is an event followed by an event somewhere else that has no precursor?
Not in this kind of scenario, where the spacing between the two mirrors, the size of the extra dimension, is so microscopically small that we don't resolve that time scale.
Okay, thank you.
And so it happens like this. Okay.
The other part is the mirror-mirror analogy. I mean, I can use that in class like day one. I mean,
yes.
Did Kaluza-Klein come up with that, or is that
No, this is the Kaluza and Klein's story. In fact, maybe it was Klein's story, was to think about an extra dimension which is of small size simply because it closes in on itself. It's a circle. But the story of more interesting ways of compactifying the extra dimension has a long history. A lot of it has happened in a plausible way, has occurred within string theory discoveries. And there are a number of ways where this mirror can be realized in string theory. So the structure of the mirror, if you like, has a number of different incarnations within string theory. In my work, I've used some of these ideas. I've simplified them in some way in my work with my collaborators. But it certainly doesn't originate with me in any way. I think this is part of the zoology of what can happen within string theory.
Let's thank Raman again. Thank you, Gordy.